Hi, I'm Don Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that does its best to portray reality in the way that each of us perceives it. Of course, we can't always make our individual perceptions agree, which actually is good. Few things are more boring than a critical consensus club. In fact, we might have a few disagreements on the trio of films that we'll be discussing this week, especially considering each offers a different take on what's real. Kelly Reichardt's narrative film First Cow, for example, offers up an authentic look at 1820s Oregon, while the Ross brothers take a more documentary-like, emphasis on like, approach to bar life in their film Bloody Nose Empty Pockets. Finally, Mark Bosco and Elizabeth Kaufman opt for a more standard documentary style to reveal the life of the Southern writer Flannery O'Connor. Let's begin with a trek back to the Oregon frontier. As Kelly Reichardt showed in the 2010 film Meek's Cutoff, life for American pioneers wasn't easy. We learned that early on in First Cow as we watch Cookie, played by Shia LaBeouf lookalike John Magaro, roaming through the Western Oregon woods. The cook on a team of surly trappers, one of whom chastises Cookie for not being able to find the food he wants in what he calls a land of abundance, Cookie forages for what's available, which is mostly mushrooms. Life for Cookie changes when he befriends King Lu, played by actor Orion Lee, a Chinese man running from Russians who he says want to kill him. Pretty soon, the two arrive at the same place called Fort Tillicum and team up to steal milk from the cow owned by the local governor, played by Toby Jones. This allows Cookie, who actually is a trained baker, to make baked goods that the two of them are able to easily sell. Amid all her attempts to capture life as the people of the time lived it, Reichardt, as is her wont, imbues her patiently told, slow-moving story with a sense of foreboding that is balanced, though never completely quelled, both by her immense filmmaking skills and the affection that our two protagonists have for each other.
So last week we talked about the Japanese filmmaker Hirokazu Koreeda and talked about how his films have this deliberate meditative pace. And maybe we should have saved that conversation for this week because Kelly Reichardt's sense of pacing is maybe even more deliberate and even more meditative than Koreeda's, which has kind of been a problem for me in the past. I feel like some of her movies have been lauded. I know a lot of critics have said that Meek's Cutoff is, you know, one of the great films of the last decade or the last century, whatever you want to say. And it never quite hit me in that way. But all of her movies have these very kind of elemental, simple stories so that they almost have the feeling of a fable. And First Cow is no different. And this is one of her best films, I think. This one actually really affected me a lot. And the exact plot that you just described, Dan, that's the extent of the film. I mean, this is not going off into different subplots. It's not getting distracted by kind of needless action on the margins. It's about these two guys and their quest to basically make a living for themselves in the early days of the American frontier, at least on this side of the country. And it kind of had, I mentioned a fable, but it also kind of reminds me of when you're reading a history book and there'll be like a paragraph about one specific incident or one specific figure from the past, and it's meant to illustrate this larger trend, and then the history continues on. That's sort of what this film feels like. And I think you're right in pointing out the friendship between these two guys, because there's a tenderness there that's so completely at odds with the brutality of their surroundings. And it's interesting how they team up out of necessity at first. They realize that they each have strengths that the other can capitalize on, but they come to understand each other and their desires and their hopes and realize that they're both aiming for the same thing and that that friendship actually develops. Of course, we have the benefit of knowing the future, not only of America itself, but because the very first scenes of this film, which are set in the present day, allude to the fates of these two characters. And spoiler alert, they're not great. So there is a sadness that creeps into the story as we watch them planning for their future. And I think that's absolutely indicative of just American history in general, which I think with these two films, Meek's Cut Off and First Cow, I think is sort of what Kelly Reichert is up to. So she's always dealing with themes of people being dwarfed by landscapes, or people with, either contentious or loving relationships to the earth itself. But here she's weaving that into a grander kind of historical context. And I actually found those two kind of alternating modes to be really effective here in their own kind of gentle way.
And I would give a shout out to her, because the focal point of both Meek's Cut Off and First Cow are the Pacific Northwest in its territorial incarnation. And we're simultaneously anxious and sort of relaxed as we're watching this film, because we're anxious because we see the survival mechanism that people during this era had to have in order to survive. And we also see the whole, there's a threat of violence, I think, like we're waiting for something bad to happen, you know, at sort of every turn. And so we are sort of feeling, are we being deluded into this sense of maybe complacency and mundaneness when they're working on the cow and baking the, you know, the cookies, making the baked goods that everyone covets and so forth. So the pacing, Nathan, I agree with you, it's slow, but then it sort of segues into these periods where we, our emotional reaction is, gee, what's going to happen? What's going on? Who are these people? And I liked that about this film, but I'm one of those people, I'm not going to say it was the film of the century, but I really did appreciate Meek's Cut Off. And I thought Michelle Williams was amazing. I don't know either of these actors, but I would like to see more from each of them.
Yeah, I'm glad that you talked about the intro, which, Nathan, that is maybe 3 minutes long, and maybe 2.5 minutes of that are watching a ship go up like the Columbia River or something, because it is what sets the tone for the entire film. And yet, at the same time, the relationship between these two guys, even if we may have some indication as to where it's going to eventually end up, she never falls for the Hollywood trap of giving us one big scene in which there's the denouement. You know, it's like she leaves it to our imagination. And I really appreciated that. And although this movie most reminded me of Meek's Cut Off, which was set in the arid plains of Eastern Oregon, and this is in the lush forests of Western Oregon, a movie that I could not think of all the way through is Midnight Cowboy and the relationship between Joe Buck and Rico Rizzo. The same way that they have a friendship there that develops over really harsh circumstances. And, you know, the same thing happens here 150 years earlier. So,
well, and I think, you know, when talking about First Cow, you mentioned the fact that we don't get the big payoff, the big dramatic payoff that you expect, at least not in the traditional sense of what Hollywood considers big dramatic payoffs. And in fact, the very last shot of this movie seems abrupt, and yet it's just right. It's the exact right way to end this movie. But I think that what she's doing here is much more clever than it even lets on itself, because I think with both this and Meek's Cut Off, she's very casually and very effectively demystifying our notions of what the American frontier was like. Just kind of how we were taught about it. You know, we were taught stories of heroism or great defeat. And here we just sort of see mundane stories, everyday
stories.
And a lot of
mud.
The one thing I have to say is they're also kind of puncturing the idea of the American Western film as well. This isn't, you know, grand sweeping vistas. It's, you know, it's much more grubby and muddy.
Intimate.
The thing we have not talked about, and we have to recognize Dr. Pete Porter at EWU here, we have not talked about the animals in the film. Because
the cow.
One of the stars is clearly Eve or Evie. And Nathan, did you send us a little backstory on Evie? And
Dan did
send us a little backstory on Evie and how she ended up being the sort of focal point of the production, because She wanted to be around people, and a lot of these animal actors do not. But she's not the only animal star. There are some sort of close-up shots of owls, of dogs running through the city area and so forth.
Yeah, and let's not forget the one last thing, the portrayal of the native Indians of the area, which are probably given the word Tillicum, Fort Tillicum, which is where they come from, which is a Chinook word. They're portrayed in a way in which they are observers of everything that's going on. And in fact, Gary Farmer, who we remember from Smoke Signals, plays a local Indian chief. And he's portrayed in a way that is proud, that is, respectable and even honorable. So it's not like she forgot the people who were here originally anyway. And I think that overall, the three of us really, really liked First Cow. And that was our discussion of First Cow. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, and Flannery. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
When you consider the future, please consider Spokane Public Radio in your estate plans. Your gift to the SPR, Fund for the Future Endowment, will ensure that access to real news, meaningful conversations, and great music will continue forever in our communities. One of the most impactful ways listeners can help is through planned gifts. Details are available from the business office at Spokane Public Radio, your tax accountant, your attorney, or the Inovia Community Foundation, formerly known as Inland Northwest Community Foundation. More information at SpokanePublicRadio.org/membership. And thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed Kelly Reichardt's First Cow. Let's now move to Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, and Flannery. And let's begin by spending a virtual night in a virtual bar. At first sight, Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets seems like an inspired kind of documentary. It's set in a Las Vegas bar called the Roaring Twenties on the establishment's final night of existence, and a whole range of characters comes in and out to celebrate the event. Pretty soon, though, even less than astute viewers should start to pick up clues that not is all as it seems. And of course it isn't. Conceived and filmed by the filmmaker Ross brothers, Bill and Turner, Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets would be more correctly classified as a documentary-like reality show. The Rosses chose their actors, they gave them costumes and general backstories, and then filmed them over the course of 18 hours. The bar in which the filming took place isn't even in Las Vegas. Except for a few outside shots, the production took place in New Orleans. That's not to say that Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets doesn't boast an authentic feel. Actors such as Michael Martin, a New Orleans actor on whom the movie focuses, have a lot to say about the angst of life, even if what they say is more for dramatic impact than any actual attempt to pass on some life-saving advice.
I did not read very much about this film at all prior to seeing it, because I saw that it had been advertised or characterized as a docudrama. So right away, we knew something was going to be a little different here. And I guess the question that I would ask, it does feel like a cinema verite documentary, but we discover relatively early on, as Dan indicated, that it's not. So how do we feel about that? I mean, I think I would like to spend a little bit of time maybe focusing on that, because there are things that I really liked about this. I think a lot of it was improv, but at the same time, do you think people will feel cheated or bamboozled or befuddled by what's happening here? Or can we just appreciate this for the sort of reenactment? Dan, you referred to it as a reality TV. Can we appreciate it for what it is, or is there something more happening that we should be discussing?
Well, I've seen this movie twice now. And the first time I saw it, I was kind of hung up on, you know, sort of the methods of its making. The idea that it was sort of being positioned, at least within the film itself, as real life. But the filmmakers themselves have been very open about how they made it. Of course, you would have to go and search those interviews to know that it was fake, because the movie itself unless, like you said, you're picking up on clues, doesn't reveal its hand. But the second time I watched Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, I kind of thought that the methods came across as more of a MacGuffin, because I think regardless of your knowledge going in, I think you'll probably have the same experience here, because regardless of how this movie was made, I think there's tremendous truth in it. And it's the kind of truth that usually comes out like when you're totally smashed at the end of a bar and just start spilling your guts to whoever happens to be sitting next to you. Yeah. That's sort of the vibe of this movie. And so even if the setting is fake, and even if some of the characters are fake, I think the atmosphere is totally real. And so I was thinking of the Maisels brothers, of course, a fictional version of the Maisels brothers, but there's a lot of John Cassavetes in this movie too, who often use, you know, similar methods with improv heavy scenes, but with actors. So I think that what they were trying to accomplish here, which is, you know, creating the ambiance and atmosphere of a bar that's supposedly on its last night of existence, I think works incredibly well. And as you're eavesdropping on all of these arguments and conversations and flirtations, even, you start to understand who these people are and what their relationships are to each other. And so by the end, you really start to like them and kind of hope that they find something better after they wander out into the morning, you know?
This really is a family and it's presented as such. Now, the question is, did they go a little bit too far in trying to show the range of diversity of people who could conceivably find themselves in a setting such as this? And I'm still a little skeptical about that. So what did all these people have in common? They like this bar. They seem to have some maybe drinking issues, we could say.
Yeah.
And they were yearning for some sort of human connection. Would all of these people with their different backgrounds, et cetera, find one another because of this bar? Maybe, I don't know. The fact that it was set in Las Vegas was an intriguing feature. I mean, we know it wasn't filmed in Las Vegas, was an intriguing feature of this movie as well. And I was like sort of chuckling about that all the way through.
Well, they do prominently feature the wedding chapel that I got married in. So yes. I was, you know, very, very pleased with that. I also want to mention though, one thing before you talk, Dan, is something we haven't brought up is that this film is set right before the 2016 presidential election. So there's this very specific tension that's right beneath the surface. I think we all remember what that felt like. So in that way, this movie is kind of weirdly valuable as a time capsule of that very moment.
Yeah, I should say that we stream this online and it's being offered to a number of theaters, but I would suggest people stay at the very end because there's a short featurette that the Ross brothers use in which they do a Zoom meeting with all the cast members and everyone explains what's going on. So at any rate, that was our discussion of Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets. Let's close with Flannery. Most everyone who has taken a college literature survey course is familiar with the name Flannery O'Connor, a Southern writer who died in 1964 at the tender age of 39. O'Connor is perhaps best known for her novel Wiseblood, which was published when she was just 24, and the darkly titled short story, A Good Man is Hard to Find. Co-directors Mark Bosco and Elizabeth Kaufman, using archival footage and recordings and augmenting them with talking head interviews and her elaborately done animations, give a decent Cliff's Note version of O'Connor's life. From the controversial parts, especially her depictions of racial attitudes that reflect her small town Georgia upbringing, to the personally painful episodes, especially her long bout with the autoimmune disease lupus. The next step for those who want to know more, though, is simple. Read what she wrote.
And that's always our dilemma when talking about biographies of writers, is how do you capture what happens in a writer's life? And there are many different features of Flannery O'Connor's life that they chose to focus on. I liked the interviews with contemporary writers explaining what her influence had been on them. I also knew that she had been ill, but I thought this documentary presentation, you know, showed us a lot more of the struggles that she had to deal with. And not only the fact that she has to move home with mom, because that was certainly a struggle in many respects. I like the animation sequences. I don't know if they segued as easily into the film as we've seen in some other documentaries that use that technique, but Flannery did not shy away from discussing some of the more controversial aspects of her life and career, because, as you indicate, Dan, a lot of vitriol has been sort of focused on her as a result of her writings that now in modern sensibilities seem very problematic in terms of sort of racist stereotypes and so forth. It also talks about her Catholicism and how that had an impact on her writing and her life. But I'm not sure that it really captures completely what that divide is. It goes close and looks at the divide between Catholics and Protestants in the South, but I probably would have appreciated a little bit more about that. So I don't know. You, as we've talked about before, you are both writers. I'm interested in your perception of someone who is a writer being portrayed on screen.
Well, I discovered Flannery O'Connor when I was a teenager and wanted to write like Flannery O'Connor. She's one of my idols in terms of the tone that she strikes, because it's such an unusual tone, that blend of kind of wry, dark humor and, you know, brutal violence. And I love that about her. The thing I liked best about Flannery as a documentary, which obviously I went into interested from the beginning on the subject, is them delving into sort of the racial elements of her writing and the diverse backgrounds we get of the people talking about that. So I think that's the element I liked best. If you're a fan already, you're going to enjoy this. But yeah, like you said in your intro, Dan, maybe this will point people in the direction of her work, which I think is stellar, some of the great American literature of, you know, the mid-20th century.
Yeah, she's definitely unsparing in her look at Catholicism, in her look at faith, the questions of faith, the mystery of faith, and in depicting racial attitudes of the South. So it's going to be challenging for some people, but she's a great writer. And that was Flannery. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, and First Cow. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial. We'll again seek out interesting cinema wherever we can find it. Until then, remember this bit of advice from one of Nathan's favorite musicians, the late John Lennon. Reality leaves a lot to the imagination. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.